Hi everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the Product Marketing Insider podcast. I'm your host, Lawrence Chapman, and I'm the Senior Copywriter here at Product Marketing Alliance. I'm continuing to turn back the clock to the Product Marketing Summit in San Francisco, where I welcomed a bunch of guests to the live podcast stage for in-depth, insightful discussions on a variety of topics. And in this episode, I'll bring you my chat with Harvey Lee, VP of Product Marketing here at Product Marketing Alliance. Harvey's passion is in product and business innovation, based on a strong proficiency in product marketing on business lines worth up to $1.5 billion annually and active user bases of 30 million globally. We discussed how product marketers can communicate the value of their product. Okay, so day two here at the Product Marketing Summit. I'm delighted to be joined by Harvey Lee. He's the VP of Product Marketing at Product Marketing Alliance.
Hello, morning.
Harvey, good morning.
How are you doing?
How was day one? Enjoy it?
It was really great. I mean, 1,000 people on site, super busy. Looking forward to day two.
Fantastic. And so just to start, can you just take us through what your role is at Product Marketing Alliance for us, please?
Yeah, sure. So I'm the Vice President of Product Marketing for the Product Marketing Alliance. And I've been here full time now for about 8 months. I have two fundamental core responsibilities. One is that I lead the L&D, the Learning and Development Portfolio Strategy. And the second is that I lead our new consulting business, our product marketing consulting business.
Oh, fantastic. Fab. And then what does it, moving on to the actual topic of the talk. So we're going to be talking about demonstrating product value, but what does product value look like to you?
Product value is sometimes misunderstood within product marketing spheres. Ultimately, for me, it's through the prism of the eyes of your target market. That's the fundamental orientation, and I'll probably say that a number of times this morning, is that product value is something that's tangible or intangible as a gain, not always to solve a pain, as a gain for the target market. So it's not an internal perspective, it's an external perspective, right? And then there's a number of things that we have to do to be able to define that, whether it's tangible or intangible, and how we do it, who we do it with, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so what kind of steps do companies need to go through to define their, you know, the product value in a way that's super clear, super, you know, succinct, but effective at the same time?
Sure. Well, I think the first thing to understand is that the starting point is an orientation of the organization. So it's not just, what do we need to do to get to define product value, and all of a sudden you have tangible product value. Unfortunately, it's never quite that simple. So the starting point really is the orientation inside the building, inside the organization, and the DNA of the organization. So is the organization or the company that you work for sales-led, marketing-led, product-led? Is it customer-focused, market-orientated, or in many cases, is it internally focused in any of those kind of perspectives? Ultimately, what we really need to get to is a market-led, customer-focused orientation, which means that the state of mind for the organization, the perspective, the orientation, is an external one, not an internal one. And that's the starting point, right? Without that, actually, it becomes quite difficult, right? Okay. So if you're a sales-led organization, the metric by which your DNA is led by is an internal one. How much money are we going to make? How much money do we need to make? And that leaves aside the concerns, the perspectives for what happens outside the building, which is really, at the end of the day, all that matters. If you can build and fix for pains and gains outside the building, what happens inside the building, by and large, will look after itself. So number one, it's the orientation. The second part is the rigor, right? So trying to discover what the value is often doesn't come just like that, right? It requires patience, and time is the most precious commodity inside the building, inside the organization, not money. Most people think it's budget. Of course, it's important, but more important is the time to do the work and get it right, right? So the second part is understanding what the rigor for discovery is and going through the discovery process to try to define and identify, or should I say identify and define, what is valuable. But then the next question is, what is valuable to whom? So I then identifying the target market. So there's a number of processes that you'll need hard skills to do that. So the ability to do segmentation, the ability to do competitive analysis from a market and from a product point of view, to size and measure that market, and then lead the conversation inside the building about who is our target market and make the right strategic decisions. That's one part. Often that doesn't happen in a robust way, right? Because these are all foundational things. So you segment, you target, you position, right? To do those three things, what we call the holy trinity of marketing, you need to be able to understand what the value is, why you win, et cetera, et cetera. And you can't do your positioning without understanding that in the first place. So there's a process, and understanding that process, it can be fairly linear. It should be fairly linear. And there's a rigor. So there's a cadence for doing it. So I think a lot of mistakes companies make is they think it's a one-off. Let's discover the value. Let's do this research and this research. We'll find it, and then we'll just execute upon it. To some degree, that's correct, but it's only a small piece of the pie. Really, what you want to be able to do is constantly talking to customers and prospects, understanding the segmentation, the landscape, and reviewing it on a regular basis, and having that cadence is really important. So a lot of product marketers ask me, you know, how often should I review this thing or this, you know, targeting or segmentation, or how often should I refresh my personas? How often should I look at different segments to review whether we should target them and try to identify what the value is? And my answer is a simple one, but it often sort of just depends as well. And the most common answer to all questions I usually get is, it just depends, because there's never a black and white answer, right? But the rule of thumb for me in a reasonably mature organization is once a year. So you need to have this rigor of, first of all, the discovery process takes a good 6 months, right? Again, time is the most precious commodity. So once you've been through the discovery process, you've identified certain things, you've tested, stress tested, let's say you've done alpha, you've done MVP, you've done prototyping, and you've tested it, and the validation has come back. So through the discovery process and the validation process, you've identified certain value that has some level of competitive advantage, and you've launched, and you know, all being well, everything goes well and everything is well in the world, then you need to make sure that just be aware that that is not the end of the process, it's just the beginning. Because of course, once you're in the market, the process of competitive response and the market dynamics trigger, and it's the vicious cycle kicks off, especially if you're successful. The more successful you are, the more the response will come back to you in yeah, cyclical sure. terms. You need to have the cadence to be able to respond to that on a regular basis. And what I mean by that is every quarter you're doing a re-review, every year you're doing a full re-diagnosis of the market to go back to say, what were the results? Were we successful? What could we have done better? Look at the measurement, look at the competition, et cetera, et cetera. That also means re-reviewing your segmentation, re-reviewing your personas, re-reviewing your positioning to make sure it's absolutely spot on. That's, of course, if the business has an annual planning cadence. Some businesses do it more frequently, right? But at the very minimum, it should be annual. So two things in summary. First of all, make sure that your orientation of the company is correct and you're focused on what happens outside the building, because then that will help what happens inside the building flow much easier. Second, make sure you have the cadence correct of all the right work that needs to be lined up to identify, but then the rigor to keep it fresh and the ability to keep coming back and reiterate and watching the market. So it's two steps within one.
Okay, fantastic. And just looking back at what you were saying before, just about some of the difficulties that can almost materialize, you know, when you're trying to communicate the value of a product. In your personal experience, what are some of the challenges that you have faced yourself, and how did you overcome those?
Yeah, I think sometimes, I mean, there's many, right? So I don't think we're going to have time to go into all of them. If we just pick a couple. I think the first one, as I mentioned a minute ago, is the DNA and the culture and the orientation of the company you work for is often very challenging. To define what that means is that usually when you go into a role, or even if you've been in a role for a while, that company is going to want you to hit the ground running. They're going to want execution. They want to see results quick, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why I mean, you know, time is the most precious commodity.
Yeah.
So that's number one. The second is the misunderstanding of what needs to be done. at a functional level, and then understanding the personalities involved of getting the work done. So I think sometimes people drink their own Kool-Aid and think, oh, we're going to do this kind of campaign and marketing is going to communicate this, or the sales team are going to position it or pitch it in a certain way. And I think that, you know, by and large, there's often mistakes made, and it just comes down to communication and alignment. And this is one of the areas of value for product marketing, to make sure that the strategic value, the understanding of why we're doing things, how we're doing things, and when we're going to do things, and how it's going to get done, is very clearly defined with all stakeholders, clearly communicated, and then centrally driven, right? Yeah. So I think that that's another common mistake that's often made in organizations, is, you know, we all run off and do our thing in our domain without really having all tied back to one core central objective.
Okay, fantastic. And you've worked on quite a few like notable projects, like most notably the launch of the original Xbox, you know, video game consoles, which I'm sure was, you know, really exciting to work on. But how have you what processes did you and the rest of your team put in place to differentiate products and compete in a really saturated market?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult challenge for most of us, right? Because, you know, software's eating the world. There's hundreds, or in some cases, thousands of competitors, right? And there's more than one way to sort of address this. And not all are super obvious, right? So in some businesses that I've worked in, the competitive advantage was never as clear as you would have liked it to be. So in the Xbox case, we built the most powerful video games console in the world. But the question is, was that meaningful to the audience that we were targeting, as meaningful as our key competitor, which at the time was PlayStation 2, which wasn't as powerful? You could debate that for quite a long period of time. And I think the orientation of that is, internally, it was considered important. I think in the media, in the specialist media, it was considered important. In the eyes of a certain segment of core gamers, it was considered important. But for the general market, not as important. And the reality of it is that gaming is an experience-based thing, and power only gets you so far. The product feature only gets you so far. The reality of it is, especially on multi-platform, is they all play the same games, right? So if you wanted to play Madden or FIFA on PlayStation 2 versus Xbox, sure, it might look slightly better on Xbox because it's more powerful on the first Xbox, but PlayStation has the ubiquity, it has the deal with FIFA and Electronic Arts. You know, so it's not everything. And the key part here is, the best product doesn't always win.
Right?
Yeah. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Another one is that, what, you know, when you have a product that is same or similar to the market, let's use the MarTech space, for example. So let's come back to B2B software. So if you take the MarTech space and you look at the MarTech landscape, there's 8,000 software products this year in the MarTech space. 12 years ago, it was about 50. So 12 years ago, it was good enough to launch a product in that category and just tell the market about it. And you could speak to the CMO directly and you could get mindshare from them, right? And there was a need for your product and it was understandable and there wasn't that much competition. So in that case, in that situation, it might have been that the best product could have won. But you wind the clock on forward 12 years and it's not always the case. The reality of it now, with 8,000 competitors in different subcategories in the MarTech landscape, is that it's just impossible, right? It's a sea of logos, 8,000 logos. Markets and potential customers have just switched off because it's just white noise. So back to your question, how do you stand out there? Well, actually, one key way that some people do it, and there's still a lot of space in which other people can still do it, is through a process called narrative design. It's like how you develop and how you deliver your story. And it's not necessarily about the products, and it's in a whole different orientation to just pitching your product and saying, hey, we're better and this is why we're valuable, etc., etc. Because unfortunately, that's what everybody's saying, right? So through our courses and through our mentorship and through our programs at the PMA, actually narrative design, as we've raised the awareness of what narrative design is in terms of storytelling and how it works with positioning. We've got a great master's course about it, actually. And these are some of the things that product marketers can look to break out of the status quo.
Yeah.
Because the reality of it is, if you look at most B2B startup, mid-level growth companies and their websites, they all look the same.
Mm.
Same color palette, same kind of illustration style. And it's just really hard to even look different, never mind be different.
Yeah.
So the question you have to ask yourself is, how am I going to break the status quo?
Yeah.
Narrative design is just one example about how you can do it.
Okay, and in terms of any common mistakes that you've seen during your career when people are trying to demonstrate their product value, can you take us into a little bit of detail and explain anything that you may have seen where you just thought, right, that's just a massive red flag, you're doing everything wrong, and how can people avoid making those same mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one is a simple one and it's easy to understand, and that is when you're pitching your product or you're demoing your product, however it is you're communicating it, just don't go straight in with the feature first mindset, which is the biggest mistake that we see happening all the time. So we do the pitch, we fail to set up the context, which is what is the market reference, mm-hmm. that and the pain point, and setting up the context around the pain point. And we just go straight in and go, oh, we're best because we have this and we have this and we have this and we have this. First of all, that's what everybody's saying.
Yeah.
But second of all, and most importantly, no one cares.
Yeah.
Sorry, but nobody cares. And the reason that no one cares is that they don't understand what tangible benefits are being delivered and what that value, and they can't put the building blocks of where that leads to value, right?
Yeah, how does it fulfill the user needs?
Yeah, it's basically. Great, it does this in megabytes and teraflops or whatever it is. What does it mean to me? What does it mean to me? So when we're in technology companies, it's just too easy to fall into this trap. And it's a trap. And it's a very common trap, because especially if you're based in the product team in the organization, or you're tech heavy in terms of organizational balance, let's say 3, 4, 5, 10 product managers to each product marketer, it's very easy to be influenced top down by the organization to go with a feature first mindset. My guidance to all product marketers is resist, right? Take the time to think it through, change the orientation 180 degrees to what happens outside the building and come back in, and just start with value, right? So that's the number one biggest common mistake. I think the other one is just not understanding the value from the customer's point of view or the prospect's point of view, and pitching what you think the best value is. And again, this comes back to orientation.
Yeah.
You think the value of your product is X, but the customer thinks it's Y, right? And that's because you didn't do enough research, insight, outside of the building, right? Whether it's as a one-off or as an ongoing process, and you didn't understand it. Or you're influenced by internal opinion rather than external fact.
Yep.
And those are two very different things, and they often don't match, right? Mm. But external fact should win every single time. Yeah.
Okay, and how about if a company wants to actually increase the value of their products and reevaluate everything, sit down and think, right, how can we communicate this in a much better way? What would you say they can do to execute that effectively?
Well, I think there's lots of different ways you can think about it. It's not just about how can we change the product to be of more value. I think it's actually, the question is a much bigger consideration. And let's take Adobe as a use case, right? So a few years back, Adobe had standard software suite around their creative products, right? Photoshop, Lightroom, et cetera, and they were standalone annual multi-year software releases. So every 3 or 4 years, there would be a new version.
Mm-hmm.
And for lots of reasons, most people would have to upgrade and spend quite a significant amount of money, right? And that used to be the Microsoft Office model as well, right? Yeah. That was the old software model. Adobe changed the value proposition of the same product by doing two things, right? First of all, they put the entire product in the cloud. It was the same product, but by putting it in the cloud, they enabled synchronous working, accessibility, and that was number one. Number two, they changed the business model. So they didn't change the product that much, but they changed the business model, and they changed it from not annual, but multi-year releases based on, you know, big ticket items to ongoing subscriptions and a perpetual product that was continually improving, right? So instead of waiting for the 3-year update, you know, with minor improvements in between,
yep.
The value here for you to pay monthly or annually would be that every month or every week or on a frequent basis, the product would just get better
and better
all the time. And so they move basically they move to the subscription world, right? And it took them 2 years. It was extremely difficult. I had some time with their CFO at the time because the company I was working for was moving to the same model and I was leading that from a product marketing perspective. So, you know, we had half an hour with the CFO at the time, Mark, and he ran us through the internal process of, you know, why they did it, because piracy for them in context of their situation, piracy was rife, as it was for Microsoft as well. So people didn't want to pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars every 4 years for the latest version. So they'd see an annual spike in revenue for the first year, and then for 3 years, it would be like nothing, right? And then piracy would be prevalent. The second part is it's just about having a better product consistently, right? So when you change the business model, that it enabled them, by putting it in the cloud, it enabled them to consistently update the product, convey value constantly, and change the conversation with their users. It also, as a byproduct, helped bring piracy right down, right? Because you don't download the product, you have to have a subscription in which to do it, right?
Yeah.
So it was very difficult for them. It was also difficult for Microsoft, my former employer, to do. But for those big companies, they didn't really have a choice if they were going to protect their model, because whether it through piracy or lack of engagement over time, they could see that their revenues were at risk after the first year of a new launch. So that's how they looked at increasing value. They didn't just change the product. The product didn't change that much to begin with. It sort of evolved over time, but in order for it to evolve over time, they had to change the business model from give us $700 every 4 years to give us $7 every month.
Yeah.
Different proposition. Now, what's interesting is that the commercial results were very interesting to analyze. Maybe not surprising that in the first 2 years, of course, the stock for those companies was a bit challenged.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as bad as you would think. So yeah, the revenue went down as expected, but the stock didn't follow the same curve down. Why? Because the market understood what the company was doing and saw benefit, long-term benefit. They'd made the right decision in the eyes of the market. So when the commercial results started improving after 2 years, the stock market actually hit a trajectory that was higher than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
And now Adobe really is enjoying, you know, 20% exponential growth year on year, which is unbelievable for a company of their size. But if they hadn't made this change, they wouldn't be booking that, you know.
Yeah.
So that's just one way, right? And they understood where they were with the market, they understood the market need, they understood the risks of not doing, right? And then they had a bold vision in which to drive organizational change. And for both companies, it took a good couple of years.
Yeah.
Again, we're back to time. So you have to have the conviction and the ability to carve out that time for the organization to make it happen.
Yeah. Okay, and just switching our attention to almost like innovation being a massive part of, you know, marketing in general. So what's the most innovative way that you've seen a product position their product? And what was it that made it particularly memorable for you?
I think that innovative is a word that's, I think, sometimes overused. And we think that, certainly from, you know, being in tech, we look at innovation as, you know, some kind of technical nirvana that's pushing the envelope, you know, putting men on the moon or on Mars or whatever it would be. But the reality of it doesn't have to be that extreme, right? It doesn't. Sometimes doing the simple things really effectively and really well is enough to land impact, right? And maybe it's a little bit politically incorrect, but there's a great app, and it's a free app called Muzzle, which pauses notifications at the critical moment when you don't want notifications. So let's say you're making a presentation, or you're on a video call, or whatever it would be. the last thing that you want is your notifications popping up, especially if the content of the notifications is like, yeah, I didn't need that.
Yeah.
You know, but even from the most subtle things like, you know, your partner saying, oh, we're out of milk, or yeah. something menial, it's like you just don't need that, right?
Yeah.
Muzzle literally muzzles your, like a dog muzzle,
yeah.
literally muzzles your notifications. In a way, the product itself is not that innovative. The way that it's communicated and positioned is where its genius lands, because it lands so well with its target audience.
Mm.
And if you just search Muzzle app, M-U-Z-Z-L-E, anybody watching this will see what I mean immediately. It's one web page.
Mm.
And on that one web page, they have the value of what it is, why it's valuable, and the use cases all on one web page. Within 5 seconds, you get it. Mm. You don't, with no effort.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's fantastic positioning. It's fantastic understanding and orientation from the developer of what the pain is, how to communicate it, and demonstrate the use case all together on one page. And for me, that's really, really the basics done fantastically well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very often more important than trying to push the envelope on innovation, especially in the tech space, because your customer or your target customer may actually not care as much as you do.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So for me, that's more important.
Yeah. Okay, fantastic. And, you know, it's been an awesome chat. I wish I could, you know, go on for another half an hour, but, you know, it's time is very much of the essence. But just to round things off, Harvey, I just wanted to let you, just ask you basically, you know, what's been your biggest product marketing success story of your career so far? I mean, you've clearly worked on so many different campaigns, did so many different products, but what's the one that stands out and makes you think, I'm really, really pleased and really proud to have been a part of that?
How do you define success? I mean, success can be defined in so many different ways, can't it? It's hard for me to say that there's one. There's maybe two or three notable ones that I'm proud of for different reasons, right? So, of course, the work that we did on Xbox 20-odd years ago was notable because everybody knows it, right? Mm. But when we started on it, nobody knew it. So building a brand and building a product that was commercially successful, despite all the bumps, some of those bumps were craters, but despite all the bumps over three generations of hardware, certainly from my perspective, you know, the volume that went by my desk in my time there went from zero to 50 million units just in Europe, right? So being a safe pair of hands, growing a business from zero to 50 million units is, for me, a notable success. I think on a personal level, the role that I played in that, you know, there was one or two areas specifically that I was particularly proud of. One being about halfway through the life cycle of my time there, my tenure, in the annual planning process, 50% of that volume was down to specific things that I did that was measurable and tangible.
Right? Fantastic.
So the ability to measure your impact at scale from where we, especially in context of where we started from, was really pleasing. I think also there's been other times in other companies, you know, redevelopment of innovation projects and transformational projects internally at companies. And I won't mention the name, but there's been one or two cybersecurity companies that I've worked for where the product has not necessarily been so innovative, but how we positioned it to the pain point actually redefined what the product value was to the target customer, right? And those transformational projects where we had to move, a little bit like Adobe and Microsoft, where we had to move from downloadable software on static product licenses to cloud-based, subscription-based proposition. In terms of the organizational capability to make that transformation, it's absolutely enormous at every level, from operations to the C-suite to alignment in the organization to a different mindset, from selling individual products to selling subscription, nurturing in the subscription economy. So making that happen twice is also, you know, a notable item for me as well. Anyway, we don't have time to go into other things, but you know,
fantastic.
There's more than one.
Oh, Bob. Yeah. Harvey, it's been an absolute pleasure as usual. So thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the rest of the summit.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you. Nice one.